Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I told the state and also the EPA, I said, we have no protection other than you people. I said, you are our front line and our defense. And all we're asking is that you assure us with testing that we're safe.
That's John Gailmore, just one of the people interviewed by NPR for the investigative series Poisoned Places, Toxic Air, Neglected Communities. Gailmore of Kansas calls one of these poison places home and, like so many others, puts the blame on the federal EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, and state regulators for not doing enough to keep the air clean. 20 years after the strengthening of the Clean Air Act, hundreds of communities are still exposed to dangerous chemicals and pollutants spewing from facilities across the country, according to a joint investigation by NPR and the Center for Public Integrity. NPR and CPI obtained a secret EPA watch list of nearly 500 facilities that the EPA has been keeping track of. They've made that list, which includes several New York City area locations, available to the public now. Joining me now from Washington to talk about the series and what they've discovered about Clean Air Act regulations are Elizabeth Shogren, environmental reporter for NPR, and Jim Morris, project manager at the Center for Public Integrity. Welcome, both of you. Hello.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Thanks a lot.
And Jim Morris, before we get into the watch list and what's on it locally, tell us a little bit more about what the 500 or so facilities on the list have in common. What does the list tell us exactly?
This is an internal list used by the EPA, enforcement staff to try to target facilities that not only have committed violations of the Clean Air Act, but haven't been subject to enforcement actions in a timely way. And our analysis showed that the vast majority of the facilities on the watch list are considered high-priority violators.
Elizabeth Shogren, a look at the spreadsheet of the watch list, which you made available through NPR and CPI, and we have a link to your site, by the way, at WNYC.org. Listeners, click on Brian Lehr Show to go right to this. Show several New York City area facilities that are on the watch list. Battery Commercial Associates on Battery Place in Manhattan, Harlem Hospital, the North River Wastewater Treatment Plant on West 135th Street at the Hudson River, the Newtown Creek Wastewater Treatment Plant in Brooklyn, one in the Westchester County Department of Environmental Protection purview in Yonkers, and the Co-op City River Bay in the Bronx. So what does it mean that these sites are on the list? Should people who live in Co-op City say, oh, my God, we're on a pollution watch list? What does this actually mean?
Well, it means that the federal government is giving these places extra scrutiny because they've been on the list of plants that, or they've been known violators of the Clean Air Act for longer than the headquarters would like to see. So we're not sure with every plant on the watch list exactly what the story is of why it's on there.
But we don't know how bad the pollution is, in other words.
Right. Well, we do know that they were noted as violators and that they've been violators for 9 months or more, and so that raises the flag for the federal government to look into it. And then once the federal government is looking into it, each plant has a different story of what it's doing wrong. I guess there in some cases there might even be mistakes, but in most of the cases these are plants that have been violating the Clean Air Act for a long time. But each plant's story is different.
And what do you have to do, Jim, to violate the Clean Air Act? You know, people are always complaining about EPA regulations and paperwork burdens and things like that. If you fill out a form wrong, can you get on this watch list?
It could range anything from a record-keeping violation, which may or may not be serious, all the way up to, you know, a major discharge of an extremely toxic chemical like benzene or arsenic. So there are actually 10 criteria. I won't go through them here, obviously, but there are 10 criteria that make someone what they call a high-priority violator, which is pretty much what it sounds like. It's the most severe level of violation. So again, it could be a record-keeping problem all the way up to a major chemical release.
So, for example, in the instance of Co-op City, there had been boiler malfunctions apparently, and appropriate fines had been paid. So perhaps that has been fixed.
I don't know about the specific details about these New York plants. We didn't research the New York City plant, so we can't really comment on what exactly went on there. And even if we had researched them, we might not be able to tell you because, frankly, it's a very difficult thing to see through. I mean, the government will tell us a little bit, and it does have a lot of data online that a person can read. But we tried to find out more about lots of plants and had a hard time finding out about it because, of course, the plants don't want to look like they are bad neighbors in their neighborhoods. And they're not always eager to tell you what they're doing wrong or what even the agencies think they're doing wrong. And in some cases, the state and the federal government disagree about whether these plants are doing anything wrong. They might be polluting a lot, but the states and the federal government might disagree about whether or not it is violating the law.
Why would the EPA be secretive about this or a state environmental agency? These are supposed to be public records, public agencies, aren't they?
Well, they we spoke with some lawyers who had headed the agency or had senior positions in the agency when the watch list was created. And they described to us a situation where what they were trying to do is they noticed a problem, and in part because the media had made them aware of the problem, that plants were violating pollution laws for too long and that the government wasn't cracking down on them. So they decided to create this list as a way to try to rein in that problem and to get a handle on it and prevent plants from falling through the cracks. So they did that, and they were trying to decide how do we structure this thing, and they decided to keep it secret because they wanted to maintain, one of the reasons is they wanted to maintain an element of surprise. They didn't want to tip off polluters that they were looking at them with a microscope in case they might send federal marshals over there for a search warrant or a raid or something like that. That's one reason. Another reason is that there is a very tricky relationship between the EPA and the states. Some of the states don't like EPA watching over their shoulder. And so they were keeping this list secret in part because they didn't want basically air their dirty laundry in public.
Yeah. And so, for example, Jim Morris, the New York City Department of Environmental Protection, which runs the North River Wastewater Treatment Plant that got on the watch list of the federal EPA, it responded to that entry by saying, most of the violations are related to reporting requirements and not the failure to achieve air quality standards. So that brings me to a question of reporting requirements. What's the system that's in place for how the EPA and state agencies monitor emissions and compliance with the Clean Air Act?
It's largely an honor system, quite frankly. And as we pointed out,
we know that works well.
Stories. Yeah, it works really well. And as Elizabeth's story on Tonawanda Coke in New York State proved, it certainly does not work well. And a lot of it's an honor system. A lot of these bigger facilities operate under what are called permits that are supposed to set limits, that do set limits on how much pollution they can emit. But it's very hard to enforce those permits, to do proper monitoring. The states are stretched pretty thin right now because of budget problems. So it's very much an honor system. I would say to anyone, to any member of the public or to any other journalist, the watch list should be used as a starting point. It shouldn't be taken as, okay, this is a list of the 400 worst polluters in the country. I mean, there's no doubt that some of them are bad polluters, but there's a much bigger universe of 1,600 or so high priority violators. And from our own reporting and NPR's own reporting, we know that some of those are really, really bad actors. And for whatever reason, they're not on the watch list at this very moment. I would take the watch list as a kind of a roadmap or a starting point.
And so NPR environment correspondent Elizabeth Shulgren, you reported from Tonawanda, New York, near Buffalo, where residents did a lot of the heavy lifting to bring attention to underreporting from the Tonawanda Coke plant. What happened?
Well, it's really a remarkable story. What happened is Some people, some of them with serious diseases, some of them with just a lot of symptoms, started getting together in New York and saying, why are we all so sick? And in Tonawanda, New York. And they tried to figure out why they were sick and thought, well, maybe it's the air that we're breathing. And they asked the state lots of questions, and the state really didn't have any air monitors in that area at all, so they couldn't really tell them anything. And so the people took a bucket sample. Just basically a 5-gallon bucket that you might find at a hardware store like Home Depot. Theirs was from Home Depot. And they used a baggie and a handheld vacuum cleaner. And there's a very scientific method for doing this. They sucked some of the air into that bag, and they sent it off to a lab to analyze it. And the benzene levels in this sample were off the chart. And so they brought it to the state regulators, and they said, you know, what is up here? And one of them hinted that there was a likely culprit, a plant called Tonawanda Coke. But this plant was, according to the regulators, it was complying with the Clean Air Act. It wasn't violating its permit. And so there was really nothing they could do about it. But the folks there they didn't take that as an answer. They decided to start recruiting people who lived close to the plant to report whenever there was especially bad smoke coming out of the plant, and to tell the media when they had symptoms. And they gathered a big group of people together, and they kept pressuring the state. And then the state did get a big grant from EPA to set up its own monitors and started testing the air in a much more exhaustive scientific fashion. And that took a process of years. And throughout that process, the people in that community just kept pushing. And so they eventually were able to find out that there was a lot of benzene in their air, a lot more than should be, and that would greatly increase the risk of cancer for people who live downwind. And eventually, although it took 5 years, the state, after that first bucket test, the state finally said, yes, it's from Tonawanda Coke, where you guys thought it was from 5 years ago. So it took 5 years. And now, and actually 7 years, if you count till now, when there's a real crackdown going on at that plant now. And they're forcing a cleanup. And Eureka, when the plant basically does what it was supposed to be doing all the time, now the air in those areas is much cleaner and much safer for people to breathe.
And for people listening who may be surprised that it's so hard to detect the benzene in the air or the source of it, when people know what they're looking for and know where they think it's coming from, here's a clip you have of the New York State Environmental Conservation Commissioner Joe Martin on exactly that.
Hazardous air pollutants are difficult to detect. We didn't have the equipment originally to do the type of detection, you know, police work that EPA was able to do.
So, Jim Morris, EPA is better equipped than the state environmental agencies?
I'm not so sure about that. Again, some of the states certainly are having budget problems right now, but some of these problems date back years or even decades. And some of the states we've visited, and we've been to 10 of them between us and our NPR colleagues, some of them just really are business friendly. And as Elizabeth said a few minutes ago, really don't like the EPA sticking its nose in their business. So I'm not sure I buy that they didn't have the technology. Maybe that may be true, but
here's a very candid statement from Judith Enck of the federal EPA, who oversees areas which include New York State, on the politics of it taking so long in Tonawanda.
If this was in, you know, an affluent city where thousands of people lived, I think there would have been more of a laser-like focus on this earlier.
Jim, she's saying if this was in an affluent area, there would have been more of a laser-like focus. Do you think environmental standards just get less enforced in lower-income areas?
I think certainly our reporting suggests that. It's hard to imagine that a situation like Tonawanda would have been allowed to go on for years or decades in a not even in an affluent area, but even a middle class area or an upper middle class area. So, yeah, I think there's certainly some truth to that.
So before you both go, Elizabeth, when we hear about the EPA in your story, it's about how stunted, in effect, the agency has been in Washington. Certainly environmental advocates say that all the time. and hear some evidence of how difficult it was to get them to act in this series. But Politico reported yesterday that the EPA is going to be a GOP target in the 2012 election cycle as being too hard and stunting the growth of business too much. Just last week, the Senate managed to reject an attempt to block new EPA controls on power plant pollution, blowing downwind to other states. So there was a move to try to stop them from enforcing that. How does that fit in with your series? You're telling us the EPA is too weak, and it looks like a major battleground issue in 2012 is going to be the EPA is too strong.
I think it's really, really interesting. And I think what you're seeing here is in fact reflecting a reality. Putting pollution controls on plants, meeting EPA's requirements, is not cheap. It can cost $100 million or even more to put on a scrubber on a power plant or something like that. We're not talking small change. So industry is reluctant to do what the Clean Air Act requires them to do. Not everyone in industry. That was way too sweeping a statement. Mm-hmm. There are companies that are reluctant. And so I think it is a very difficult situation because EPA regulations are very expensive. That is true. But on the other hand, those EPA regulations provide health benefits to the communities that that live near these plants that are dramatically higher than what the cost of those pollution controls are. And so it is a tricky situation. You know, what do we value more? Do we value a healthy citizenry that that has lower medical bills and that lives longer? Or do we value more plants having less money to spend on pollution controls? I think that part of the problem is that the debate is all about killing jobs or creating jobs. And the part of the debate that I think gets short shrift even by the Obama administration is that the EPA's job is to save people's lives and to make their lives better, to make children who have asthma not have as many asthma attacks, to make people not develop cancer in areas where there's a lot of toxic air pollution. And I think that voice of describing just what are the after effects of all this pollution is something that we hope that this series will help draw some attention to. Not that we're trying to be political with the series, but I just think that this is a situation that I think a lot of people just don't know about. And you can go to npr.org and find the map there for the Poisons Places series, mm-hmm. and find your community. And you can find out, are there plants there in my community that I didn't know about? And what kind of pollution comes out of them? And is it something I should be concerned about?
The series,
it's power.
Poison Places, Toxic Air, Neglected Communities. Elizabeth Shogren, environmental reporter for NPR, and Jim Morris, project manager at the Center for Public Integrity, have been my guests. The two organizations worked on this investigation together. We also have links on our page to their series and to the watch list, WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And finally today, start calling now with your suggestions for the day one inbox for the new head of the MTA, who starts work today, Joseph Loda, 212-433-WNYC. Some of them have been coming in on our comments page, WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show to post there or call us up. Your suggestions for what should be in the day one inbox of the new MTA chief, Joe Loda, 212-433-WNYC. Pete Donahue, the transit reporter from the Daily News, has six suggestions of his own, and he'll join us and call us up with your suggestions for the day one inbox. What would you write to Joe Loda on his first day on the job as MTA chief? 212-433-9692.